Hello, Denim Heads, and welcome to the 12th Hangout with the Sons of Selvage podcast. This is a podcast where a group of friends get together to talk about denim, menswear, and related interests. We aim for this to be a fun and inclusive podcast where you feel like you're hanging out with longtime friends, but be warned, there's a bit of banter, cutting up, and explicit language. So this episode, we've got a couple different bits for you. We've got a bit of current interests, a bit of news, a bit of Q&A, and we've got a special guest this episode, our friend Ed Anthony of Stanford Vintage. So that's going to be a pretty exciting discussion topic. Make sure you hang around for that one. As always, please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcast. Also, please follow us on Instagram at Sons of Selvage Podcast. Lastly, message us on Instagram with any questions you'd like us to discuss in a future episode. And if you're interested, reach out because we've got a Discord server that you're welcome to jump onto. So on that note, let's jump into current interest. Who'd like to kick that off?
Hey, everybody. Future David here. Just to let you know that Lex is actually on holiday this week, so you won't hear him throughout the episode. But we actually have our guest, Ed Anthony, hanging out with us for the entire podcast, so you will hear him. Thanks.
Actually, the last episode was quite a while ago, eh? It's about 2 months ago, so I'm in the midst of winter here down in Australia, so you can imagine how cold I am. So I had to upgrade my winter wardrobe a little bit. So I bought a new sweatshirt, a Knickerbocker sweatshirt with just a big logo at the front. It's quite cool because the logo is all stitched on in Velcro, so it's in red Velcro. It's probably one of the most softest sweaters I've ever owned. So it came in super handy. I don't have any, surprisingly enough, we live in a pretty modern building, but we don't have any aircon or central heating because they don't really do that here in Australia. And the room I'm sitting in now is my office, but the sun doesn't hit this room, so it stays pretty chilled throughout the day. So I do need to wear sweaters every now and then, which I never thought I would have to when I moved down to Australia. But it is true. It does get colder every now and then. So hence I had to buy some winter gear. But apart from that sweater, I've also bought a Wax London overshirt. So one of their whiting shirts, which is amazing. It's like a woven checked shirt. So I've got it in the navy color. So it's got navy, yellow, and red in it. It's absolutely amazing. Again, one of those things that has kept me warm through winter. And it's nice because I can wear it as a jacket or a shirt. So it's got two uses out of it, so which is quite nice. And then the last thing as well. So this is probably one of my first, since a long time at least, pants that are not actually denim. So I bought Benzac Denim Developers chinos. So it's in their relaxed tapered fit, the BC02, in a dark brown Selfridge canvas. And I think, David, you picked up a pair recently as well, but in the industrial blue Selfridge, I think. They came in a couple of weeks ago. I haven't been wearing them too much yet because of my competition pair I'm still wearing until the end of September. I've worn them a couple of times. They're super soft, a bit stretchy, which is, again, something because I haven't worn any non-denim for a long time. Not something I'm very used to. So,
Sounds
great. It does for you, yeah. Don't get me started, mate, with those tiger stripe shorts, yeah. They must be stretchy.
No stretch, mate. No stretch at all.
Oh, no stretch in those. Oh, wow. Okay. No.
Just stripe. All stripe.
Cotton twill, mate.
I'd love to pull that off, Ilya. You pulled it off. I could not pull that off.
What, my shorts?
The shorts, yeah.
You want to pull off his shorts?
I'd love to. No, Tom. Hang on, where is he?
Subscribe. The Sons of Selvage OnlyFans.
I'll be coming Sons of Selvage uniform, mate.
Yeah, we definitely need to get a joint photo of both you guys wearing your shorts, like lifting kettlebells or something. Very, Vladimir Putin style.
It can be arranged.
Macho-ness.
Preferably in the snow.
Don't worry, it will happen.
Brilliant. Love it.
Those look good, Kevin. I'm just winding up.
That's all right, mate. That's all right. We can take it.
I guess to... Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
No, I was going to say that was it for me. So go
ahead. Yeah, I was going to mention, I just saw this morning on, I think, Snake Oil Provisions Instagram, they posted this like RRL Western shirt that's like a floral Western.
Nice.
And I was like, Kevin's got to see this.
Send it my way.
Kevin is responsible for the new trend of very wild patterns on shirts that we're seeing throughout the community.
Nice.
I'll take the blame. I don't mind.
Cool. I guess if I can kind of build on Kevin's current interest, I've had a bit of a journey recently with Benzac Denim Developers, which I wanted to speak about. So I think I was on a retailer's website in Europe and saw this basically like a Lee Ryder style jacket that Benzac did, the BDJ02 Ryder, in this kind of really cool kind of grayish light indigo denim. I picked it up at that shop, but then lo and behold, they actually didn't have it in stock, so I was a bit kind of bummed. So I ended up messaging Leonard, who's the owner of Benzac Denim Developers, on Instagram at Ilya's recommendation, and sure enough, they actually had one of the jackets in their warehouse in Amsterdam, so was able to kind of snag that jacket, and I'd been on the hunt for some t-shirts anyway, so I ended up picking up a couple of their BT01 t-shirts. For me, they're kind of perfect. They're not loop-wheeled, which I don't really understand enough to pay the premium for anyways, but they're like heavy jersey, you know, I don't know the exact weight off the top of the head, but like 230 grams or something in that ballpark. Pretty good shirts for kind of taller folks. Like I often find the heavyweight tees are cut a bit shorter. So yeah, I'm 6'2" and they're a good length for me. And this, the construction's really solid. So I'm wearing one right now and really, really happy with those, and definitely recommend if folks are looking for like a great heavyweight tee and maybe 316 isn't the right one for you for whatever reason, but you still want to pay somewhere in the kind of $50, 50 euros ballpark, definitely check out Benzac shirts. And then also, yeah, I've kind of gone a bit down the rabbit hole with some of their stuff in the sale they've had recently. So I got some of the BCO2 chinos that Kevin mentioned. And yeah, I just want to mention that, like, you know, folks are interested to kind of check out brands in the same ilk as like RGT or 316 in terms of like modern cuts with really, really good construction, really solid fits. Definitely looking at Benzac. They're really good customer service wise. You know, and the garments themselves are quite impressive in terms of like design and fit, etc. The only kind of caution I would give is that all of their sizing is sort of tailoring based. So Black Horse Lane works the same way, and I think RGT works the same way. So all three of these brands are by makers who have a tailoring background. And so their waists aren't vanity size. They're actually like...
Future David here. I meant to say that the garments are vanity sized.
If I measure around my gut, I'm a 30. But if I just say like what size garments do I buy, I'm usually a 32. Because like where they sit on my waist, that's like a 32. So you got to be careful with Benzac, and that, you know, I basically had to buy a 30 in all of their garments, even though it's like measures like a 32 measurement wise. So just check their sizing charts if you buy from them. But they do pretty cheap flat rate shipping worldwide, which is cool. So yeah, I guess in short, I'm kind of a convert now, and I definitely will be buying stuff from them in the future. Obviously, there's a little bit of things that I was a bit surprised in, that, you know, like, for example, in that Ryder jacket, the button-down pockets on the right-hand side versus the left-hand side. So as a right-handed person, it was a bit odd to use the same side as your hand. But maybe Leonard's a lefty. I don't know. But definitely check them out. And that's me on that one.
Yeah, I've had my own and a pair of Benzac chinos. to replace those studio Dartisan ones, which if anyone's interested in, are available at a decent price. Just message me on Instagram and we can chat.
Sponsored content.
Got it.
Yeah, actually, on that note, they've got a pretty insane sale on their website right now. I think as much as like 70% off some of their bits. So definitely take a look, and if they've got the right size for you, there's some pretty insane deals right now.
Yeah, cool. I'll have a look. Especially the it's the Olive Chinos I'm after, because those Studio Dartisan ones are slightly too slim on the GAM and butt and pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, boy.
I might as well go next. Unless you've got anything more, David.
Go for it.
Right. I've got a couple of bits. First one kind of sticking in with clothing and tying in with our chat about a certain pair of stripy short shorts. I picked up the Mr. Freedom Advisor jacket in Tiger Stripe as well. So I now have the full pajama set.
Nice.
So there will be, at some point, we have discussed it, expect to see on the IG page a video of me hiding in bushes in very short shorts and a little jacket. And maybe some of my old army boots, which I still have sitting in the attic. So maybe you'll be lucky and you'll see me
on the news.
It'll basically
that as well. Yeah.
BBC Look East. Yeah. Short shorts. I'll do the infamous commando montage in really, really short shorts.
What about you coming out of the swamp? What's that famous? Is it?
Oh, what, Apocalypse Now?
Yeah.
Coming out of a small ditch by a cycle path.
Yeah. No, my pale legs.
I picked up the jacket. It's the same fabric as used in the shorts. Buzz Rixon provided it. It's a people haven't seen it yet. It's gold tiger stripe, so it's a very kind of bleached or boiled, quite bright pattern. It kind of reminds me to an extent the old in the 90s you used to see in the British Army the boiled DPM tropics, where they kind of, in order to kind of treat them so they were kind of mozzie proof, they would coat them in loads of kind of chemicals, and then they get boiled, and they ended up getting this really, really bright color to them standing out, and it became like almost like a status item to see soldiers having a set and then instantly being told to never wear them again. So it's got this really nice color to it. The stitching inside has got kind of a rainbow pattern to it, the thread that's used, which is really nice. Christoph did it. It's kind of to make it feel a little bit more relaxed and casual, even though no one really sees it apart from you. And then it's also got two internal like sunglasses or phone pockets that are kind of a bright orange fabric, which is a really nice touch. It's kind of a bit like a barricade, like a Harrington or a bomber jacket, like flight jacket in design, but really, really lightweight. Got a few comments when I went into the office this week wearing it. So probably not something to wear in the City of London again, but brilliant. And then the other kind of item of clothing I picked up, I don't know if I mentioned the last one, but I got a pair of the warehouse herringbone twill olive fatigue pants that are very high waisted, which is a nice change. Obviously, we spoke about it on the last one, our kind of individual styles, and this was my step in dipping my toes into kind of Ilya's world of high waisted, wide legged cuts. Don't expect me to be doing it all the time, mate. why are there penguins on my screen? What?
I don't know what that was.
Aside, someone passed her in.
You told.
That wasn't
But yeah.
I was like, what do the penguins do?
I was in London with my wife. We were celebrating it was a birthday, actually. And we nipped into Son of a Stag because I wanted to pick up the very same Henley that Ilya is wearing right now off his back. But he wasn't there. And yeah, we saw these trousers, and my wife was just like, try them on, Andy. She had no idea what kind of cut they were or anything. She's like, just try them on, they look quite nice. Yeah, put them on.
You said it was her birthday.
Don't worry, presents. Don't worry. She made me buy stuff for myself. Maybe it was a present for her. Maybe she just really likes me.
She's the one looking at you. So.
Exactly.
Just dressing up.
And my 22 followers on Instagram. We tried them on. We went off. And then I had to go back to the store and buy them because it was one of those items, you know, when you put them on and you start thinking about it. And the more you think about them, you're like, actually, that was exactly what I wanted. And I'm actually wearing them now and they're dead comfy in the morning, especially after eating a load of pizza last night. That's good. And then I've got one more item, but I'm happy for everyone else to chime in first before I start waffling on about other crap.
We could always do a second round if folks have
extra bits to add. It's a very, very quick one. But,
Since we're on the garments talk, I'll continue. Whilst I was on holiday, I managed to put an order in for a Tweard MFG jacket,
nice.
Which had arrived once. Actually arrived earlier, and when I got back, I managed to open it up, and I was really pleased with it. So it's a HBT Rider coat. It's a chore style jacket, which is kind of workwear inspired, but also kind of touches upon motorcycling culture in Japan, where people in the scene would wear white because it would be racing at night, so you know, to have that visibility. And the Jaegers likes to use ecru as well, so it's something that kind of makes sense for him. And so this particular fabric is a HBT, and it's from Collect Mills. It's about 7 ounces, so it's quite a lightweight, nice for spring, summer. It just as per usual, the construction it's so clean. It's a wonder to look inside of the jacket and just to see the little touches, the angles that he uses for the pockets and for the different seams. They've got piping in there to make it, you know, neater. It's constructed with like triple needle lap seam machine. So yeah, all the kind of things that you want. And it's something which is a little bit different for me because I'm usually not a big fan of chore style jackets, but this piece really stood out for me, and I'm kind of actually wondering whether I should pick up the bottom half of the set with the rider ecru suit. Maybe not all in all, but they're kind of. They are very similar in cut to my Buzz Rixon fatigue pants, and which I love as well, which are quite similar to Andy's fatigues, which he was just talking about. That was my kind of piece from Tweard, which I'm really happy about.
Those guys are good. Those guys are good, aren't they? To I'm going to have to invest Ilya at some point. I think that
I think you'd enjoy it because it's
great. Yeah.
It's just one man brand.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and you know, does all the patterning himself, does all the construction himself. Everything from inception to construction and you know marketing and all the rest of it. And just a really nice guy as well, down to earth and. We had plenty of laughs and drinks when we were in Amsterdam for Denim Days, and I hope to catch him at some point again, whether it's in London or Amsterdam. But yeah,
no, definitely. I mean, also really good to support independent. You know, it's a great story as well. The fact he does like all the processes himself. He's obviously very passionate about what he does, and I really feed into that too. I'm definitely going to invest at some point. He's got some great pieces.
And I think it's quite difficult in this scene where everything is repro and everything looks very, you know, similar. I think he tweaks the designs to be original but still take inspiration from the things that we are into and come up with unique designs using yeah. Using the same kind of fabrics and denims and things like that we all love. That's I guess maybe for some people that might put them off because he's doing new things and unique designs that are not based on type 2 or something like that. But I think for me that kind of sets him apart.
Hard thing to do with such a saturated market as well, I feel. And but yeah, into it.
Two things come to mind. One, I think we need to try and get Twerd on the podcast at some point.
Oh, definitely.
And two, I'm starting to see the plannings here of like a, let's call it a Canadian tuxedo themed meetup where basically everyone shows up wearing matching tops and bottoms of some sort.
Yeah, so Andy in his tiger stripes.
Yeah, could it be military? Please be olive tones, then we're laughing.
Yeah. Well, each person can pick their own theme, I guess. But it has to be a matching set.
We could do a military theme one too, separately.
If we do this in winter, I could wear my Arctic parka. How about that? Looking like
I'll do it in summer.
Only with the matching the flight trousers.
Those things are bonkers, honestly. Absolutely bonkers. I was actually just while we're on the garments, I got hold of a few vintage pieces recently, actually, that I thought would be quite cool to share with you. A few little grail pieces, a late 1930s US Army denim chore, absolutely incredible. In a slightly bigger size, it's got the zinc US Army buttons, beautiful face, the denim. I'll have to share it with you boys at some point. And I also got hold of two US Navy denim shawl collars from the 1940s as well. One's a Coast Guard one variant, which is quite interesting. So I'll have to share this with you boys at some point. But the fade on the denim are to die for.
It's beautiful. I think I've seen the one that you've
The Coast Guards. You see the Coast Guard. The other two have yet to be seen.
Okay.
Going to be doing some kind of like shoots with those pieces of kit soon, I think. But I think you boys would be really interested in that.
Was that Coast Guard jacket, was that the one that you wore at the last meetup?
I think that may have actually been... No, that was a repro. That was actually a Buzz Rickson repro. Yeah. What I will say about Buzz Rickson, just quickly, is that drawing comparison on the way the denim actually fades with those shawls is pretty incredible, actually. Like, just the grain, the textures, it's so... similar, so close to the originals. It's great that I'm lucky that I can draw that kind of direct comparison between the original 30s and 40s garments in compared to Buzz Rickson. Quality is like second to none with those guys. I'm really impressed. And so that was a repro, but next time I'm out, I think I'll be rocking a shawl collar.
Awesome.
Definitely.
So I have been working with the lovely Lex, Phil Denim Workshop, who's not here because he's in Spain.
I'm not bitter.
He's on the beach sipping pina coladas. That's why.
Yeah.
Pina coladas. that's just him with just headphones. We've been working hard and going back and forth to design our second United overalls fit, which is very kind of classic, high rise, like, as high as I think I could possibly make it without it being silly. Loose cut, kind of the same big wide back pockets, and a cinch back, which is interesting to design. And then loads of rivets, very 1910, 20s, 30s style buttons. So I'm wearing them right now, which is very comfy. So I'm now part of the Wide Boys. Wide Boys!
Welcome,
boys. and then hopefully we can kind of start thinking about producing them soon, which would be fun. And then I think Lex also made me a denim apron, which we kind of loosely based around a vintage one that he had. Do you think it was a Sears one? Yeah, like a 50s Sears denim apron, which is nice. So, selvage down the sides. He's got his patented cross back straps, which are pretty cool, And then I got some grommets, although grommets, the round bits, and we're furiously trying to hammer them in at home by hand, which was fun. So maybe I'll get a machine to do that next. Literally in the kitchen, like, bam, 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 bam. No, not done yet. Bam. That's it for me. I bought a pair of like van style shoes from Stepney Workers Club about a month or so ago. Really enjoying them. I'm quite pleased with them. Really, really comfortable. Like so much more padded than the 70s Converse. So I'd recommend them if anyone are looking for alternate shoe wear for the summer.
How do they compare to the Colchesters, mate?
Thicker. Thicker on the sole, I think. Yeah, like all of the rubber and the rubber siding is like super, super chunky, thick rubber. So it looks like they were just like, yeah, make it as thick as possible and as durable as possible. Nice, solid footbed in there. So yeah, really pleasantly surprised. So I was just like, it could end up like the Converse 70s where you wear them like once or twice and then all the padding in it goes. But no, really pleased. So I would say a tiny bit comfier than the Colchesters.
Cool.
Awesome. Anybody else have any extra current interest they'd like to mention? I think Andy, you said you had something.
Yeah. You guys will know as I harped on about it constantly when it occurred shortly after the last podcast recording and last release, I hit the 1,000-pound club, and that's not in my body weight. How much so yeah, I've been doing strength training for a couple of years now. I'm not great at it by any means, but I hit what was it's considered kind of the first key benchmark on kind of strength progression. So it is, guys, it's going to bore so many people, but basically the 1,000-pound club is, it's you and your combined bench press, squat and deadlift equals 1,000 pounds. So it's like 450 something kilos. I can't remember off the top of my head, I can't remember the conversions, but it's kind of just below, it's between 450 500 kilos combined.
Congratulations, mate.
So yeah, and then I subsequently stalled and completely went nowhere after that, and I'm taking a step away, and I'm probably going to try Olympic lifting in about a month or so's time, see if I've got the shoulder flexibility for that.
You're not going to be able to get through doors soon, Andy. You'll be like that. Top tiny. Look out. Get a door. Double doors, please, mate. Nice.
Sorry, my boy.
Yeah, you'll be cutting those threads on your type 2s.
Carrying carpets.
Next meetup, you're just going to have to fireman carry me around.
Like a baby. You've wanted me to do that anyway, so.
Yeah, I keep asking you, but you'd never do.
Maybe now. I pretty much only do strength training now just so I can carry my son around. Because that little boy weighs a ton.
Baby squats.
Mate, you should see he has mastered the Astagrass squat now. The full-on Slavic squat. It's perfect form.
Oh,
he just does it, stares at you with a big grin on his face. And you're like, I lost all that flexibility years ago. And I'll never get it back. And he's just there rubbing it in.
Is he actually just pooping?
sometimes. If he stares, he never smiles. He stares at your face. Deadpan.
The stare. A thousand mile stare.
And then all you hear is... yeah, ah, little man's gonna shit.
We've gone back to the ASMR channel now.
It's the noise you make.
At least get him some like Fisher Price dumbbells. That way it doesn't look so offensive when he's doing it.
He's got a dumbbell. He's got a kettlebell. He's got a little bike. That's the thing at the moment. Zooming around the house on his little bike. He had some of his friends around yesterday, and he was crashing into him on it and stuff. Kid's going to be a maniac.
Brutal.
Full on feral. I love it.
Wild abandon.
I'd be been hearing him screaming while we're downstairs, and my wife saying no a lot, so he's probably trying to stick his fingers in power sockets again.
Oh, God.
Maybe this is what happens.
If we lose Andy, then he's had a power cut.
Yeah, video drops and there's grunting in the background. We know what's going on.
Electric poo, boogaloo.
Got one more interest I'd like to share, please.
Cool. Go for it.
That's okay. So yesterday I was at Bolt London, which is a shop slash a hang spot in North London, Stoke Newington. And there was a launch for a magazine called Dead Slow. And you can find this at What's Pandora. And the magazine is about looking at current culture and how it's changed in the digital age, and kind of what the choices are between the physical world and the digital, and you know how it affects our lives. And it has interviews with musicians, with workers in factories, and other really interesting people. And it just kind of looks at these themes and. Yeah, really interesting. And alongside it, there's a video series which you can find on the website. The chap behind it is called Planton Poulas, who's kind of the driving force, and him and his partner Tori, who helps with the videos and the photography, have put this together. So it's really nice to see the work come to life, and just to hang out yesterday with some great people. So yeah, I'd definitely recommend checking it out. The website is pandora.co.uk. So you can find more information about it. And the magazine itself comes in a vinyl shaped format, in a little sleeve. Yeah, it's really, really interesting. Nice to have print magazines in your hand and to look and peruse.
And it looks like that's What's WHATS Pandora, Pendora.
That's the Instagram handle. Yes. Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, that's my current interests.
Awesome. Anybody else?
Nope.
Cool. All right, let's jump over to the news. So I guess to kick things off, maybe something that we might all find interesting is Tailor Stitch has, which is an American brand based out of San Francisco. I know those guys back when I used to live there. I think I was their first international customer. It's like right when I moved to Paris, I bought one of their bespoke shirts they used to do. But anyways, they've just done a partnership with Atelier and Repairs, who used to be based in London plus LA. And I think these days they're just in LA to do a bunch of sort of like custom garments that are, actually I haven't done my homework here. They're either like edits on existing Tailor Stitch garments or like potentially kind of like patching up and repairing.
I mean, it looks like they kind of had extra stock of seasonal or core bits, and then asked Atelier and Repairs to customize and add bits and bobs and patches and all sorts, which looks very interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like, yeah, I guess you're right that as they took, okay, yeah, extra units of some of their kind of Oxfords, chinos. Instead of, you know, kind of getting rid of extra inventory, which is something that some brands are known to do, they basically called up Maurizio Donati, who's the kind of creative mind behind Atelier and Repair, and had him kind of go to town on them with patches and stuff. That's really cool. It's worth a bit of a mention on Atelier and Repair in general. If I understand correctly, they never work with any materials that are not either like dead stock or new old stock, whatever. Like they basically never touch brand new fabric. It's got to be vintage or dead stock, et cetera. So it's pretty cool to kind of see Tailor Stitch, who's a bit more of kind of a modern fashion brand that, you know, does seasons and all that kind of stuff, try and think about how to sort of work with existing things as opposed to like buying more stuff.
I used to bring my jeans to Atelier and Repair to get them fixed up. They were around the corner from Riven and Hyde in London, or not too far away from there.
Yeah, I had my favorite Imperial jeans get repaired by them ages ago, and it's a shame. I think the London showroom shut down, and they just kept the LA location open. But yeah, they had some really cool stuff in there, like garments they've reconstructed, stuff they like took apart and put back together, like, and obviously just did really great alterations and repairs.
It was funny, they were in this, like, I don't know if this was the same location, but the couple of times I've been there, they were in this like tiny like basement room in this like shared office building, kind of. Well, it's not even an office building, it's more like a old Victorian house or something, and they were in the basement. And it was nowhere, because I used to work around the corner there, so I would go, and I cycled to work, so I would go and drop my jeans off or pick my jeans up from their shop, but there was nowhere to park and lock up my bike, so I had to bring the bike inside so it wouldn't get nicked outside. So it was funny, and it's just going through this tiny corridor to get downstairs with a bike on my shoulder to drop off my jeans. But yeah, that was really cool, because it had loads of like different fabrics and stuff just laying around, and I usually get holes in my pockets from my mobile phone. So that's a couple of times that they repaired it. And what they would just do is they would just, you know, get a bunch of fabrics out and say, okay, what do you like? And you could pick, I could pick and choose what I wanted them to use to fix those holes up. So it's always pretty cool.
Yeah, I think they were off of like Little Portland Street or Great Portland Street, something like that, kind of near where Clutch Cafe is now.
Does ring a bell, yeah.
Yeah, cool stuff. Also, it's a bit of a shame because like Tailor Stitch isn't widely available in the UK or Europe, but I'm a really big fan of their Yosemite flannel shirts. So they're basically like moleskin, 100% cotton flannels, and they usually are like either solid colors, or they've done a couple camo ones or a couple like a Black Watch plaid. So yeah, I know folks often ask about like what's a good choice for like a more affordable flannel if you can't go for like an Ironheart or like a Flathead price point. And I really, really dig those shirts. I wish they were more easy to get over here.
Yeah, I recently picked up a corduroy, Indigo Dyed corduroy from them, which is amazing. Yeah, really good shirts. Highly recommend. I'd never heard of them really before, until a couple of months ago. So
yeah, they used to be kind of like a menswear market in San Francisco, where they got a bunch of menswear oriented brands to like show up, and Mike, their CEO, and I forgot his two co-founders' names, started there doing made to measure shirts. So I had a couple of shirts made. They're like sewn in Pennsylvania. Then over time they kind of progressed into ready to wear as opposed to made to measure. But really cool dudes. Like, you know, when I got into fashion for a while, Mike was very helpful in sharing some insights. Yeah, I just think they make good product. I mean, I think most of their stuff's made in Europe these days, like in Portugal. It's not made in the USA anymore in most cases. But yeah, just really well-designed garments, really, really good construction. And I quite like their fits as well. And they do kind of like the 38, 40, 42, 44 style sizing, as opposed to like small, medium, or large. So you get a bit more flexibility with size range. Yeah, it's a really great brand. I wish they were easier to get over here. Cool. Anybody else see anything interesting from the news list you'd like to chat about?
Stonewash.
Yeah, let's go there. So Stonewash jeans are going gangbusters, apparently. RGT 316. I know we talked about it a little bit last episode, but what are y'all's thoughts on the kind of pervasiveness of Stonewash?
Yeah, it's horrific.
Yeah. So you put it eloquently.
Let me ask a bit of a hot take. If folks were doing stonewashed garments, they were all done with like lasers from, you know, like Tonello or I forget the other guys who do lasers, and not actual real stonewashing, would it be less of an issue?
It wouldn't be stonewashing then, would it, though?
Yeah, and you're still damaging the fibers in the jeans.
I just don't like the look of it either. There's several aspects of it. Is the, you know, the environmental aspect to it, you know, the damage, and then the damage to the eyes that you get.
Burning off my retinas.
One thing that's worth mentioning too, because I've run across some stonewashed garments, or sort of just generally speaking, you know, post-processed garments when I was working in denim for a while, and the smell like doesn't really go away. So they use these, like, I think they call them like conditioners, or like these different chemicals they put in the process, and like, yeah, it's, for some reason just the smell like never goes away. Like, I've got that neon green Levi's trucker, and it was stonewashed before it was dyed neon green, and it still smells like the chemicals they use, and like that can't be good.
What you just described was like a ninth circle of hell for me. Yeah, it was stonewashed and dyed neon green.
All that said, if Levi's had made a neon green raw denim jacket, like I probably would have bought two of them. You know, I had to my finger didn't really want to hit the buy button, but I was like, well, screw it. One garment that's stonewashed won't be the end of the world. But I definitely didn't feel great about buying it.
I watched was it 316 done a video about it? About like why they've decided to do stonewash. And all the points they were making about, you know, kind of why they moved over or, you know, have started adding it to their ranges, just like none of them were actually any real explanation other than we want to sell to more people.
open the market, I guess.
That's what it is.
Not into it.
But. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do it with lasers, because there's, you know, at least there's less impact on the environment with it. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of damaging the denim.
I'd rather do it myself. I'd rather damage it myself.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah, I mean, they were talking about, it's to make it more comfortable because we're running around with kids and stuff. They've been doing that for, you know, 10 odd years in normal raw jeans. It's not that big a deal.
Why not just use different colors or lighter shades?
Yeah. Or different fabrics. Because we were talking about, we want a chino soft, like the comfort of a chino. Wear a chino then.
Yeah.
Do you know what I think? It's really about like just the visual aesthetic of the stonewash as well. That's used more the kind of than a softer pair of jeans. It seems more like.
Oh, yeah.
But then it's going back on looking at trends and things like that, which we're trying to move away from.
Yeah.
And these are the brands who are trying to, you know, establish themselves by not being trend driven, and, you know, doing things the right way. And, you know,
but I mean, like you said, they've got to sell. They've got to sell stuff, and they've got to constantly open up their, you know, their clientele. And as much as we all dislike it, pre-washed jeans always sell, because people are either scared off by the idea of raw denim and kind of the idea that it's this really tough, hard material to get into. And it can be uncomfortable. And then a lot of people just prefer a pre-washed item. As much as we dislike it, we kind of have to suck it up a little bit. You know, and when you've got brands like LVC bringing it in with their kind of that capsule they did recently that was based on, you know, 90s Manchester rave culture.
90s.
Where there's a lot of that.
Why is that vintage?
Mate, you say that, but it's like 30 years
vintage.
Ago. So it is enough to be, that is long enough for it to be classed as
peak
vintage.
Consumerism.
On that note, yesterday, BBC Six Music did an entire day dedicated to like 90s club culture shows. So like every program on Six Music yesterday was like all 90s you know, 90s jungle, 90s house, you know, whatever, like different radio shows worth checking out.
And all the hosts were smashing Molly and Ket just to get into the vibe.
Woo!
Really good.
One thing I'll mention too, that I've kind of recently myself kind of gone down the rabbit hole of is like eBay and Grailed. So like, you know, if you want something that's broken in or, you know, kind of like not raw, there's actually a pretty good market for folks like basically selling a pair of jeans they broke in for someone who wants like an already beat up pair. So like I sold a couple of my jeans that don't fit anymore on eBay and Grailed. And then I've also kind of like picked up some bits that either just aren't available anymore, you know, because they're from past seasons or were just like a really great price. So like I definitely recommend folks kind of lean in on that secondhand. It's not necessarily the same thing as buying vintage, but, you know, just kind of like secondhand market. You get some great deals and could find some stuff that you can't get otherwise.
I'm down with that too. I mean, I what you said is an interesting point. I mean, I rarely buy a repro, but when I do, I'll rarely buy it new. I'll always try and find something through eBay or whatever that's like, for example, those Buzz Rickson denim shorts, those short collars, it's kind of like, I won't buy it new. I'll get it cheaper on eBay, but I love the fact it's been worn in already. It's got some great fades to it. So I'm always doing that too. I'm always on eBay looking for that kind of stuff. I think that's a really good way to go too, I think. That's a lot more affordable.
It's almost like new vintage.
It's like, hang on. No, I get it. I get it. Like, I'm down with that too. I think, you know, let's be honest. Like the whole kind of vintage market, not to go off and on about it. It's expensive. These garments are expensive. The original ones are. You know, it's kind of, and I think that's what's so good about a lot of these, like especially the Japanese repros. It's amazing the quality of it. So I think that's a really good bet, I think, on eBay. Ilya, you've had some good experiences with that too, haven't you, I think?
Yeah, I buy a lot of stuff on eBay and secondhand websites like Grailed and stuff like that. It's nice looking for a bargain, and you know, some things are might be, you know, out of season or out of stock, and you know, maybe made 5 years ago. Like I recently picked up the Mr. Freedom hook deck jacket, which I've been looking for I don't know, maybe 2-3 years, and I just couldn't find it because they're quite rare, and especially in my size. And when they came up, you know, on it just one day, I was like, boom, have to get it. And you know, originally they're like £600-900 or dollars, and you know, I managed to get it for like 300.
So rad.
And hopefully, you know, I'll have it for a long time with me, and a lot of my items. And if I do get tired of something, I try and move it on, and you know, get rid of it responsibly by, you know, by selling on to people or giving it to someone that can, you know, carry on the life of it. So,
one tiny rant is I think eBay makes it really easy to sell pretty much or buy globally because they've got the global shipping program. So it's like if you want to sell something overseas, you just like ship it to like your distribution hub in your country, and eBay sorts out getting it to like someone in Japan, someone in America, et cetera. But Grailed really needs to kind of up their game a bit because they've got a great marketplace with a lot of great stuff, but it's primarily US based buyers and sellers. So like if most of the people on Grailed like don't expect to ship it to the UK, and if they do, they haven't even thought about the price. And also when people are buying stuff from me on Grailed over here, they expect to pay like US shipping and US prices. So like they're always trying to undercut what I'm selling it for. So like if you're using Grailed and you're not in the States, you basically have to like really jack up your prices because people are like, oh, shipping's a tenner, right? So like here's $10 to ship. It's like, well, no, actually to ship to the USA is about $30. And so if anyone at Grailed's listening, you guys need to up your game in terms of supporting your international buyers and sellers.
I saw there's a new platform called the Jawn Flip. That's JAWN Flip. And that's, again, it's kind of aimed at heritage scene and kind of like Grailed. So it's quite interesting.
Is that an app or a website?
It's both. Cool. I think they're quite new. So they're trying to get traction on there. UK-wise, I think Mocked is obviously a great place to search for, which is quite specialized in terms of what they carry.
Market's a weird one. So I tried to figure out how to like become a seller on there, and like you fill out this application form, and it's like, what kind of stuff do you want to sell? Is it cool enough? And it was like, it's really weird. It's like, you know, it's very obtuse, like how their marketplace works. But it seems like it's a good place to buy good stuff. But I don't really know how you sell things on there.
I've sold a couple of, I mean, both Ilya and I have sold one or two items on there. A lot of it is, or it was when we were doing it, it was kind of direct interaction with the guys or the people behind Mark. So we were kind of having, I think we were both having like WhatsApp conversations and emails and stuff like that to get stuff squared. And, you know, you were taking your photos on your phone and sending them a direct, and then they were going, yeah, we can sell that, or no, we can't sell that item because that's not a brand that we would sell. Or you know, it's got a bit of damage that we're not willing to kind of stick on our site. So it was like that. I don't know what it's like now. I think they've probably sharpened it up, and with the cut they take, you would expect that they would.
It's
like a 30% cut, I think they think. Yep. So it's if you don't want to go to the effort of putting it, you know, posting it yourself on eBay or places like that, and you just want them to handle it all, then it's, you know, it's a good platform. But just be aware that it's a quite a hefty charge that you're going to be losing on your items,
and the wait can be quite long.
Yes.
Yeah, that just doesn't sound scalable at all. I know there's a women's shop that my girlfriend buys stuff from called a Vestiaire, and it's like you just post them the stuff if it's like within a certain criteria, and then they just take care of everything. So it's like you send it off, they kind of grade it, value it, and then they sell it on for you and like give you your commission when it's sold. That seems a lot easier potentially.
I think it's quite similar, but I think it's just probably not as, like I said, it hasn't been taking it to the same level. So it's a little bit more, a little bit more to and fro between you and Mark.
I'll tell you what, sorry, just go back to eBay and the global shipping program quickly. I've definitely had a few problems with that too. It can be really expensive shipping overseas. I've definitely had a couple of pieces that are pretty expensive that I've been trying to sell, either vintage or repo, whatever. A lot of buyers have been put off just through the cost of the global shipping program. But obviously you don't have to be in that program. You can still ship without it. But I think me and eBay have probably just got a bit of a funny relationship anyway, since somebody tried to hack my account and tried to sell £100,000 supercars. So ever since that happened, me and eBay have not been best mates, really. I guess it's good that you got the option, though. That's all I was going to say. It's what you were saying earlier, David, about the global shipping program. I've definitely been put off by stuff in the States that I really wanted to get my hands on. And then you're like, oh, that seems like a really fair price. And suddenly you look at the shipping and you're like, oh, that's about £150. You're like, can't do it. And they won't. And the buyer, I'm sorry, the seller won't actually change. They'll be like, no, I want security of the global shipping program. And they won't budge from it. And that's when it's like, that's when it's difficult, I find.
That's a good point. Yeah, that like from the buyer's perspective, it can be really expensive. I obviously from the seller's perspective, you're paying like $5 or whatever to get it to their distribution hub. But that's true. If you're the buyer, the international shipping fees can be quite a lot. I really need to set something up with my parents in the States where like we all get all their stuff shipped there and they just like box it up and send it over to us. Especially because I can't.
Yeah,
cool. Right. Anything else from the news folks want to deep dive on or add to?
Well, there's that thing about BLA's bespoke jeans. Saw that there.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if we talked about that last episode or not.
I don't remind me because I told you guys on Friday that BLA appeared on children's television.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, yeah. That's a good shout. So TVs. When a couple years ago, we had Maddie Moat at BLA to do an episode about how to make a pair of jeans. mean, that was back when I worked there, so that was quite some time ago. But yeah, it was really cool. What stood out to me most about that episode was that, you know, she took the time to make sure that each machinist was mentioned. So like Ivo, Ken, Mikko, and so all the kind of like the personalities behind the garment making were actually, you know, name checked and mentioned on the TV show, which is really cool. And I know Han, he tried to kind of stay a bit in the background and let the makers sort of be the showcase of that. So that was super cool to see that become a reality. And, you know, those kind of amazing machinists and craftspersons getting to be on a TV show on the BBC. So one more thing I want to add into the news, just because it's coming up soon, is so there's a great podcast about the kind of boot culture side of things called Stitch Down. Really fun show. Recommend listening to it if you want to learn a lot about the footwear side of our hobby. But in the same way that the the international fading competition thing that you're doing, Kevin.
Indigo Invitational?
Yeah, thanks. So that in the same way that there's like the Indigo Invitational where you wear a pair of jeans for a year, Stitch Down's got kind of the same thing coming up from October 1st of this year till May 1st of next year, where you basically get a brand new pair of footwear. So that could be boots, shoes, moccasins, whatever. And you basically try and kind of, you know, see how your boots patina over October to May. It's pretty cool. They've got a bunch of different gifts lined up from kind of boot makers like Grant Stone, Wesco, Standard and Strange. So in the same way that the Indigo Invitational is kind of a contest for fade in a pair of jeans, they've now got the same thing for fade in a pair of shoes. Looks like there's a couple rules, like, you know, no sneakers, no sandals. It has to be an unworn garment, whereas, you know, I usually go for secondhand shoes these days. Brands don't matter, so it could be, you know, something expensive, up to you. That's a bit of a bummer. Apparently, you have to be a member of the Stitch Down Premium community.
$5 a month or something like that to be on the Discord.
I guess you could do it for October. So that's what, 7 months. So that's $35. That's not too bad. Or $50 for a year. You're supporting the makers. They've got $10,000 in prizes. Yeah, that's not too bad, actually. Okay.
Good. Yeah, there's a fair few MTOs in the prizes as well.
What kind of prize? Yeah, what kind of prizes are there?
I think Wesco give it one of. I think the second prizes are like a pair of the two second prizes, MTO boots from Wesco.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you've got
and stuff like that.
Got some MTO Viberg, MTO Wescos, as Andy mentioned. Some off the shelf Wescos, shell Cordovan boots from Grant Stone, non shell Cordovan boots for Grant Stone. Something new coming up from Standard and Strange, Osmo boots, goodies from Division Road, Brooklyn Clothing. Wow, it just goes on and on. It's actually pretty insane list of gifts or prizes, I guess is the right word. Wow.
Nice. Impressive.
The one tricky thing for me is that I could be kind of interested to do it, but I don't actually wear shoes anymore since I never leave my house. And if I am leaving my house, it's either for a run or a hike or a cycle. So like
wearing your horrible trekking sandals.
Oh man, Bedrock sandals are the greatest thing in the entire world.
They come on, let's be honest.
So yeah, just a shameless plug. Bedrock sandals, they're sewn in America, you know, by like a small group of makers, and they're tough as nails. Like you can hike in them, you can backpack in them. I mean, I wear them, I put, you know, every time I do like a 10 to 20K hike, I'm wearing them. They're pretty kick-ass. I guess the only thing they can't do is really, really cold weather. I'm a convert.
I'll stick with combat boots for hiking, mate.
Yeah, fair enough. Get that Gore-Tex goodness.
Mainly because I've got a massive stash of them in the attic for free, so.
Fair enough. But yeah, I don't know. Does anyone think they might want to do that Stitch Down Patina Thunderdome?
It's only for six months, what you say? October till May. I don't know how much you're going to actually patina or fade a pair of boots in that short amount of time. I already find it hard to properly fade a pair of jeans in a year's time, so...
I think unless you're working... Unless you're working in those boots, I think it's going to be quite difficult to do. I mean, I know I'm in the TCB competition on Super Future, and there's one chap who actually works, manual labor, and he just
thrashed something.
Yeah, he thrashed the jeans within a couple of months. But otherwise, I think it's going to be quite difficult, especially with boots. Unless you've got like a veg tan, you know, natty color, I think it'd be quite difficult to pick up a lot of wear within 6 months.
Or your John from Vintage Engineer boots.
Yes, yeah, but again, he's working and he's doing stuff in the garden and stuff like that. So that's different. I would pick up some patina within 6 months, but again, you probably shouldn't be wearing your boots every single day for 6 months.
Yeah, that's a good point. They should have worked into the contest some notion of like day off rotations, because wearing the same boots 2 days in a row is like a cardinal sin.
Yeah, I don't know, it's not quite the same as fading a pair of jeans, is it?
Guess I could.
Good idea, but no, I wouldn't be interested in wearing the same pair of boots every day for 6 months.
It's also a lot more expensive to get into than
that as well.
The denim ones. You know, you're looking. I mean, it says brands don't matter. So you know, you could buy a pair of £30 Doc Martens off on a sale, or get some dead stock military combat boots, which you'd be able to pick up pretty cheap if they're relatively new models. But, you know, most people will go for things like waxed flesh or kind of engineer boots and natty veg tan and stuff. So, yeah, people are going to put a lot of money behind what is a six-month competition.
Yeah, like my waxed flesh boots have taken years to get, like, a really nice patina on it. I couldn't see how I would get any traction on them within 6 months.
I'm guessing the easiest way to get into it price point wise is probably either so Clark's did that natural veg tan desert boot, and those
Of Paradise.
Oh yeah, that's right. We've never seen any pictures of them since you've owned them, Kevin. You should post some shots of them.
I will. Yeah, I don't wear them that often. They're like,
are they still pink or they're brown?
No, they're still pretty pink. Yeah,
you should put them in the sun. Suntan, put some Smiths on them, and then suntan.
Piss some Smiths.
just go buy some like suntan bronzing cream, because I guess it's skin, right? So like you could bronze your shoes, maybe.
Fake tan them. Get them in the spray.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe not. Fake tan them. Spray tan them.
Get that nice bronzing action. Or maybe some of the Indonesian boot makers like might still be at a approachable price point for Natty Cremexel. I bought some Oak Street Bootmakers Trail Oxfords earlier this summer, and I had to send them back because the size wasn't right. And my new pair will be here probably by end of August, so maybe that might be a good option. Get some indoor office fades.
Andy, can you stop speaking, please?
Sorry. My probably man is sitting on my lap.
No, we know it's you.
I just muted Andy. Cool. Anything else folks want to talk about from the news, or should we jump into Q&A?
I think one thing that I'd like to call out, I think Ilya mentioned this on our chat as well, is that one of the guys on Instagram called Robin Denim has launched their own denim brand, Realigned Denim, a couple of weeks ago now, I think. Really interesting. We've been discussing like the fit and stuff on WhatsApp a little bit already. It's right up my alley. Like I compared the sizing against my Momotaros that I'm wearing at the moment, and they're almost exactly the same, and I absolutely love the fit on my Momotaros. So they're definitely on the list of options for
me. They're probably made in the same factory as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, because I think he was using Japan Blue as the place to to source the denim and to make the denim.
Yeah.
By Collect Mills, I guess, and then the factory there to actually make them. So
stitch it all together. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So
how much are they? I don't know how much they are.
I haven't actually looked into pricing.
I think they're close to like 300. I think they're close to 300. So it's quite a high price point. But I'm guessing because of the small amounts that they've made, and to be able to go out and create the fabric in Japan and make it in Japan, it's quite a high cost.
Yes, I feel that.
So I guess that that's where the cost comes in.
Yes, interesting one. This kind of notion of sort of Japan makesmanship or design. Like I know Benzac also did recently like a collaboration jean with Samurai. So it's kind of like Benzac meets Samurai jeans. It's interesting. It's almost as if like the denim scene's kind of turning into almost like three big buckets, right? So like one bucket's like very heritage, regular straight, loose fit, high rise, kind of vintage fit cuts. 40s, 50s cuts. A
white
second
buck.
What's that?
White boys.
Yeah, exactly. And then kind of a second bucket is sort of the like 316 kind of relaxed sort of streetwear kind of more comfy bucket. And then this third bucket that's still going really strong, which is kind of like the Tanuki, Robin Denham's brand. These RGT, the kind of like really modern
United overalls.
See, I would have put United overalls more in the heritage bucket. No.
Oh, sweet, thank you.
I mean, you're the brand owner. In the wrong bucket here. What?
I mean, tell us as the brand owner, but like, do you see yourself? Do you see this notion of kind of three fit buckets and you fitting into one or no?
Definitely. I mean, like. The first style was very much that kind of tapered. I call it like the European look. They like it very tapered, literally just fits over your boots kind of style. And then, obviously style number two is white boys. It's definitely like you will probably fall in one of those three categories probably.
Yeah, I find that my like slim, straight leanings doesn't fit in any of those three buckets. So I'm struggling to find like good jeans and good fabrics that I want to buy. It's like you either got to like embrace more loose cuts or embrace more tapered cuts. Cool. Should we jump over to Q&A?
Yeah, let's do it.
Q&A! Awesome.
Let's do the first one.
I spilled diesel all over my new iron hearts the very first time I wore them. Should I just break down and put them in the washer because they smell horrible? Yes, please wash your jeans straight away.
Yeah. Use a lighter.
That's a bit harsh to diesel jeans, though. Like, just because they've touched your jeans, that's mean.
I feel like there's a pun here of saying, like, dude, you could have just saved your money and bought some diesel jeans that were already... I'm kidding.
I mean, for example, it's not just the fact that they smell horrible, they're going to have a big stain on them. And more importantly, your jeans are now a fire hazard.
And they're going to damage the fabric as well.
Yeah, so just
wash them.
It's like when people go, oh, I once poured a pint down my jeans and it was fine. I just carried on wearing them. Right, just wash them. When you do stuff like that, you've just got to take the hit and wash it. It's not going to ruin your jeans. It's going to get a bit of the excess indigo out. You're still going to be able to fade them fine. It's more, in this case... for the safety of your lower body in case you go near heat.
Just hand wash it if you don't want to like put through the rigmarole of a washing machine. It's just a bit of fairy liquid.
When you're buying unsulfurized denim, sometimes you have to soak them, three times to get the right, the fit on them so there's no problem with washing jeans and just do it. It's a hard wearing fabric and you're going to wear them and it's going to still get nice fades. So don't worry about it.
I think Giles of Ironheart's even been quoted as saying that he recommends everybody wash a pair of Ironheart jeans when they first are bought before wearing them. I think he's kind of officially said that's the way that you should break in some Ironhearts. Quick logistic question for us though. What's the best way to kind of deal with the petrol, it's like, or diesel, gas, whatever you want to call it? Seems like option number one is spot clean with like some dish soap and water, and maybe like, I don't know, kind of rub it a bit. Option two is to like actually properly machine wash them, but you know, maybe turn off the spin cycle and do it on a low temp. Or option three is like try and hand wash it in the bathtub. Like what do we think is the best option to like get the diesel off, but like not muck up the jeans?
I would recommend wetting them first, soaking them, and then put in some like a washing fabric kind of on top of it, like the powder on top of that stain, and let that work itself in for like half an hour, and then maybe just throw it in the wash and just let it go through it, and that will have the soap inside, it will have the agitation using the washing machine, and that will probably be your best bet. If you do a spot clean, you might, you know, come out with a, you know, a big patch of, you know, a different color.
I think also the key thing on this question was they said all over. So a spot clean isn't going to do anything on this. You've just got to get it in the machine.
It's gone down the whole of one leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a scene from Black Sheep where like Chris Farley was like spraying David Spade with like gas at the gas station or something like that?
Wasn't that Zoolander?
Yeah, I was about to say Zoolander.
Zoolander. That's right. Also to mention too that question was from Watch For It. So thanks Watch For It for submitting a question. Would someone like to grab another?
Yeah, from... Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, let's let it go.
Has he got them up?
Oh, has he got access to the Trello?
I don't think Ed does. Let me send you a screenshot real quick.
Oh, yeah, I don't. Yeah, hang on.
A WhatsApp you want. The picture real quick here.
Yes, okay.
WhatsApp incoming. Let's see if that makes it over.
Let's have a butcher's hook, shall we? Right. Okay, I'm having a look. Yes. Oh, do you want me to pick one, do you? Sorry.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah. If any of these are of interest.
Can someone else go first while I have a look? While I just cast my mince pies on these questions, is that all right?
Yeah, no, I'll do it. Of course, Eddie. So from Ren and Gade Heel, I'm guessing. What are your favorite shrink-to-fit jeans? How do you get them right? I'd love to hear your views.
I've got a plug maybe here without necessarily answering the question. Pigeon Tree Crafting did, well, it's just, I think he's done a great job. So Pigeon Tree Crafting did a review of some Tanukis, and he talked about like how he sizes his shrink to fit. And I think he's got like a great system. So worth reading that blog post if you want to get like a good written system for buying shrink to fit.
So what is his? Can you give a brief?
I think he said that he sizes.
Hanging, David.
I think he sizes for the unsanforized waist, and then he sizes for the sanforized everything else. So basically, it's like how big is the waist going to be if they haven't been shrunken because they're going to stretch back out, and how big are all of the other metrics going to be when they are shrunken because they're not going to really change.
Yeah,
I thought that was a pretty good suggestion.
Oh, that's a sensible one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, generally, like, I'd probably say my favorite's the Samurai's, just because it's, you know, nuts fabric. Quite often, like, a lot of the unsamurized market is that 501, very heritage look, but, you know, Samurai take it to another level. And I suppose Oni as well, but their Oni fabrics are woven so loosely that they don't really behave like a proper unsamurized denim. So they stretch out in, like, no time at all. I mean, yeah, when I do shrink to fit, I don't ever get it right, really. I always get it too small. They always shrink too much, but I don't mind too much, you know.
You don't go and sit in the bathtub with them?
I have. Yeah, and then they just kind of keep going. so, like, my Samurai S710 XX 24 ounce, yeah, the top button, just I don't imagine I could even put them on anymore with this lockdown weight. So size up generously, because you can always soak them, and then if they're still a little bit too big, soak them again.
Yeah, you had me size up twice, didn't you, on my Samurai 710s?
Yeah. Are they all right now?
Yeah, well, I think last time I wore near you, when I'd put them through a couple of soaks, and then you just went, stick them in the washing machine at 60 on a denim cycle, and I took the hit, and actually, yeah, it worked a treat. Mm-hmm. And the leather patch didn't get damaged or anything.
Really? At 60, that didn't damage the patch?
No, it was while it was drying, I put a bit of a conditioner on it, so it kept it supple.
Well, okay, because so I know...
It didn't crack like an Ironheart, like you see Ironheart patches do it all the time, but obviously they use really, really thick leather, whereas the Samurai one is kind of, I think it might even be deer skin, similar to like...
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, deer skin. I think unless you like tumble dry it or do it higher than 60, it's not going to like beef jerky patch up.
Yeah, it was a quite short cycle as well. So, well, it did the trick. But that was it was gradually getting to that point. I didn't just do it straight away. It took a few goes.
I've got so many horror stories around ruining patches, but yeah, I'm afraid to ever wash jeans over like 30 degrees. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth, you know, we've talked about it in past episodes, but expect the waist is going to stretch out, you know, over time. And so, yeah, you can shrink them. Yeah, you can kind of soak them, whatever. But ultimately, the waist is going to come back out. So I feel like find the right size where the stretched out waist is going to work for you. But then make sure you look at how much the other metrics are going to shrink, because they're probably not, you know, the rise is going to shrink and it's not going to come back. Knees, calves, whatever. Like, I've definitely bought some 316 shrink to fit jeans before, and they shrunk too much in the width, and they were just too skinny for me, and I had to sell them even though the waist and everything was right. So you gotta be careful for those other metrics, that the knees, the thighs are not really going to stretch back out.
Yeah, I think, yeah, if you're buying slimmer jeans, you know, make sure you're sizing for thighs and take that into consideration. Use the size charts and compare with, you know, jeans that you have. Most brands and shops will have post-wash size charts, so that should help. So definitely look at that and compare that. If you're buying more straight cuts and you know, wide jeans, that's not such a big factor. You're only kind of caring about the waist and the rise that you need. But again, you use the size charts. I'll usually, you know, look at what my waist will be post-wash and gauge it around there. I don't mind having a little bit of excess in my waist, because I usually, you know, tuck shirts and other bits and pieces when I'm wearing them, so it's fine to have a little bit. You don't obviously want too much excess fabric, because then, you know, it starts looking a little bit off. So, and in terms of my favorite shrink to fit jeans, I think Warehouse is a top one, because they're quite consistent in how they shrink. The denim is really interesting, just really reliable. So yeah, I would pick that out of a lot.
Seconded, yeah, they're good.
I'm always buying bigger. I think waist size. I don't think I've got any jeans, whether it's mainly vintage or repo, that actually fit me without belt. I end up almost going like a size or two sizes bigger. And I think that's just because my style was like a baggier cut, bigger size. You know what I mean? And I think that, Ilya, you're quite right. They, you know, can bunch, but I tend to just try and make it work, because I just love those baggier kind of cuts.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a look with it. That's
definitely a vibe, 100%.
It's also where you like to wear your jeans. How high up the waist do you like to wear them, or how low do you like to wear them? That makes a difference.
Yeah, definitely. Or sometimes, especially if you're buying really old, beautifully worn in vintage pairs from the 50s, you're like, I'm going to make this work. I'm going to make it work. I don't care if this waist
it will look good.
This is going to work. Yeah,
even with a camel toe and everything like that.
I've definitely done that a few times. I've been like, I've just got to have these. But, you know, great for too big, not the too small. Never catch me in skinny jeans. Ever. So there's a question from if you guys have to move on. It's at number 12 in brackets Discord, and it says, since a lot of the community is about buy less, wear longer, what do you think is a healthy number of pieces to be purchasing each year? Or it also says per garment.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we've talked about this before when we had a question about, I think this was about boots and what kind of lettuce we were looking forward to see on boots and stuff. And I think I mentioned back then as well, like I have one pair of boots that I've bought 6-7 years ago because I don't need 20 pairs of Red Wings. No offense to anyone who owns 20 pair of Red Wings, obviously, but yeah, there's just certain pieces where, in my opinion, you don't necessarily need like 20 different pairs of them in different colors and shapes and forms and whatever. But it's a really interesting like debate, right? Like we, as he says in his question, like we're all about, you know, buying less and, but like every time you scroll through Instagram, there's, I don't know, 10, 20 like brands out there that are putting new stuff out and it's like, oh fuck, that looks great. I want to get that, you know? So that list of things that, look interesting that you want that keeps growing as well. So yeah, it is hard, but I tend to stick to one or two pairs of jeans a year. If not less, sometimes depending on, you know, what I buy. And even like tops, like shirts and t-shirts and stuff, I tend to not buy too much of that either. But yeah, I can't really put a number against that. It's also because they're a little bit cheaper, so it's a little bit quicker and easier to pick up than a pair of jeans or a pair of boots, I would say. But yeah, that's what I would say about that. I don't know what anyone else thinks.
Yeah, I mean, I probably, like in terms of jeans, I will wear like one pair for about 2 years and just trash them. So I've like moved on to my new pair now, but my previous pair, two big holes on the knees, you know, holes by where my phones are. I think there was a hole in the back pocket coming out as well. So what I might do is just give them to the shop in West Room to kind of have as a faded sample, which would be cool. Boots, I think I'm kind of done with boots. I've got like a big Vibram lug-soled Red Wing. I've got lace-to-toe Thorogoods and Samara and Williams as quick slip-on ones. And that's probably me about done, really, with that. Oh, and a pair of Iron Rangers. So, you know, I think I've pretty much covered most bases with boots. And then for tops, I'm kind of like most of the way through that transition of replacing cheap stuff with nice Japanese or American stuff. So I've got some nice jumpers now and I've got the shirts and everything. So that has slowed down, but you know, I probably would have bought, you know, a couple of pieces a year, something like that. And most of the time secondhand anyway. So me personally, I wouldn't buy any more than that really. Maybe a nice jacket for the future. Who knows?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a theoretical and an actual. So I think in the theoretical, there was a couple of years where like I was actually successful in having one indigo jean, one black jean, and that was it. One brown boot, one black boot, and that was it. And like one brown belt and one black belt, that was it. So I kind of had like, I had the two boot rotation, I had the two jean rotation, and like my jeans looked awesome because you'd wear every day, you're wearing one of two. But I think the downside of this hobby and the harsh reality is that we say we want to buy less and use things for longer. I think the reality is it's buy the same amount of stuff, but at a much more expensive price point, which is the downside. But I guess the positive is, you know, this stuff does last. And so I've got, you know, 10-year-old shirts, 10-year-old jeans, whatever that I can still enjoy because I did buy well. But I think the reality of like buy less is quite hard to actually pull off.
I think it depends also like your perspective on it as well. It's like, you know, if you're looking into like heritage wear, I don't want to keep calling it repro, but it's kind of, you're looking into that kind of realm. I mean, I know with some of the stuff that I've got, you know, I might have for a couple of years, but then if I'm looking for something new around that, then I will sell, you know, my last piece to try and keep that down. But then it's also difficult if you're vintage collecting. In a way, it's a good thing because you're constantly recycling. You're not buying from new. But, you know, that's... where does that end? It doesn't. That's a whole other kettle of fish, I find, when you're actually vintage collecting, because that just goes off the chart, you know what I mean? And most of the stuff you want to wear. But then again, the way I justify that is that you're constantly recycling that. It's not, they're not new. Just try to justify it, guys.
it's a hard one. I'm definitely an enthusiast in terms of it, and I like to sample a variety of brands and fits and styles, and go down rabbit holes of exploring one particular style. So, you know, one purchase of a garment might lead me to buy other things to match with that kind of style. And also some, I'll be selling stuff as well. So that kind of, there's a system of things I keep and curate and let go of. In terms of what you actually need, you don't need a lot. It's not a matter of need. It's a hobby, I think, for a lot of us, and it's something that we enjoy. So yeah, we partake in it, and we experiment and get these things. I think what a healthy amount, in terms of jeans, like I think a few people said, you don't need to buy a jean, every 6 months. The jean will last for 2 years easily. I've been doing like a 12-month thing, so I'll retire a jean after 12 months once they've got, nice fades and nice wear on them, and then I'll move on to a new pair. I'll usually wear, that 4 or 5 times a week, and then supplement that with other pairs of trousers and things to keep it interesting for myself.
That's also a funny thing, like, which is a bit contradictory in this hobby of ours, is that we all buy these garments raw, dry denim, whatever you want to call it, to be able to fade them. But then very often, once we get to the point where we've actually faded them to a point where we like it, that is usually, like, as you said, 12 months, 24 months down the line. And then you stop wearing them because you've come onto another project, right? And you might wear them every now and then, but and what I've experienced over the years as well is that because your body weight and stuff changes, like, you want to go back to a pair that you've faded perfectly, and then you try them on, and you're shit, fuck.
But also, like,
fatter, so they don't fit anymore.
Yeah, also, like, my preferences have changed. So, like, I've got a nice, faded pairs of flatheads, which are just, I find, too slim for me. But I love how they have faded, and I will occasionally put them on still. But because of the cut, and how, what I like to wear now, I just necessarily wouldn't, go to it that much. So yeah, it's a interesting question, and it's definitely something that's.
I feel like we're in an AA meeting for men. Hi, my name's Tom.
Got a denim problem.
I'm addicted to interesting pockets on shirts.
Well, tying it back a bit to a couple of conversations earlier in the episode, like, you can obviously, like, sell stuff on to someone who just wants to get a broken in piece right away. When you don't fit in a garment anymore, you can sell it on, and for the right price point, someone else will be able to pick up that piece that's now too small or too beat up. And then also, I know a lot of people do the thing where they've got, like, one pair, their new pair of nice jeans is like their work jean or office jean, I'll call it, and like their old pair of beat up jeans is like the evening weekend jeans. So, like, you can also kind of do that to still wear your old ones around the house, like, to do chores and stuff, but wear your nice new pair that you're fading for the office.
I'll tell you what, I'm always on the hunt, actually, for, like, we're talking about, like, worn in denim jeans, and I guess when they get to a certain point, which, as you said, like, you either shift them on or whatever, stick them on eBay or whatever, I'm actually sometimes on the hunt for that kind of really lovely, like, raw denim fade, because I will get those jeans, it's probably going to be sacrilege, and I will cut them up, and I'll use that for, like, sashiko work to fix old denim jeans and recycle, essentially. Yeah, sorry, guys. I think that's quite a nice way to do it too, sometimes, if, like, someone's selling something on and it's kind of like, well, you know what, I'm gonna recycle this into fixing another garment, maybe it's a vintage piece, maybe it's not, whatever, or with something highly decorative.
Yeah, that's kind of like what Atelier and Repair is doing, right? Where they kind of take those old garments, old fabrics, mm-hmm. and make something new out of it. So that's really cool.
Yeah, no, definitely down with that.
Okay, cool. All right, Denim Heads. So next we're going to jump right into our discussion topic. We've got a guest with us today, a good friend from London named Ed Anthony. You might know him on Instagram as Stanford Vintage. So Ed, first and foremost, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. Maybe to kind of kick things off, tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are and like, you know, your love of vintage and sort of, how you got to know us all.
Okay, well, yeah, so my name is Ed Anthony and I'm an artist and I've been collecting vintage from probably around 2008. And then I've been building my Instagram account, Stanford Vintage, for last few years now. And it was actually Elia that got in touch originally about coming into your community. And it was like, you know, pleasure to meet you all and have the meetup. And I think that's kind of what kickstarted meeting all of you guys, really. I think with the Worn Out Global crew. That was pretty cool.
Awesome. And so what's sort of your focus with vintage collecting? Like, what are you interested in?
What am I interested in? Well, for me, I'd say it's mainly around the 40s and 50s. Obviously, it's built around a lot of military as well. I mean, I've always had a fascination with that because that started at a very young age with, you know, grandparents all being in the war. And, you know, I was very lucky to have a good relationship with my grandparents, especially my grandpa, who's an absolute legend. And we'd watch war films together when I was a kid, and he would talk to me very openly about his stories. Because he was based actually at Duxford. He was based at Uxbridge, which is one of the forward fighter stations in World War II. So he had incredible stories, and I was just fascinated, from that age. That really kind of got me kick-started into kind of military vintage. and then, as I got older, I got a paycheck. And then with that paycheck, I started spending that on pieces of vintage. And that was the kickstart for me, I'd say.
And actually, on that note, I didn't really do a good job of kind of framing, you know, sort of what you're famous for and like what everyone kind of knows you as. But obviously, you're into vintage, you're into World War II history, and you're an artist. Maybe tell us about your art concept. Like, what is it you do? And, you know, maybe kind of how you got going with that concept.
Well, I think, like, you know, I've for me, with kind of like the artistry kind of side of things, I mean, I've been painting and drawing ever since I was a kid, and, you know, specialized in literal or very graphic portraiture. But that got to a point when, you know, I wanted to be like, you know, how can I be more creative with this, and how can I incorporate this with vintage, essentially? So it was like trying to marry up these two very different things. And I think that's kind of what kind of kickstarted me to, you know, get more invested within vintage and then start looking at the kind of graphic illustrations of World War II and Nozar and you know, the fascinations around that too, I think. What was the question?
Yeah, more just kind of like, for all the little young whippersnappers who don't know what much about World War II, maybe just kind of framing what
who
exactly it is that you're... What's that, Tom?
Who are these people who wouldn't know what that is?
Yeah, maybe just kind of like telling us at a high level, like what the artwork is and kind of like what essentially the concept.
Okay, so the concept is, you know, looking into Nozar, and Nozar was something that was, very prolific in World War II, especially by the Americans. And, it would have been originally a way of kind of like identifying aircraft. That's kind of how it started. And, Nozar was, you can see it, it's evident in World War I. You can see there's British, Germans and French started to kind of like identify their planes with, you know, Nozar and flags and bits and bobs. They kind of started there. And then as we went into the Second World War, then it became quite prolific, almost like folk art in a way where, you know, you'd have the airmen, these young airmen who would essentially, you know, on their bomber, they'd adorn it with a beautiful, you know, clad women, which would have been like the calendar pinups of the time produced by the famous commercial artists of that time and in a way used as like a lucky charm. That's kind of like the kind of history, short version of the history of that and why the bomber crews did it. And I was just fascinated by that. Fascinated by the history because it's so personal to each crew. you know, it really is. And like I said, it is quite folk arty in a sense, and there's so much of it out there. So yeah, I'm absolutely fascinated by it. Just the sheer diversity of it as well. You know, some of it is very PC, and other parts of it are just quite comical and funny, because, you know, there's a lot of like Disney characters, and there's a lot of, as I said, lots of kind of scantily kind of women. There's a real mixed bag of things, but I think it opens up to be, you can be so creative with it, you know, because you can either replicate, you know, Noah's art, or you can kind of, you know, come up with your own kind of concepts, because there's so much out there to like pick and choose. It's, you know, it's great.
And on that note, maybe let's talk a bit about what you do yourself as an artist with Noah's art, and whether you take that in the direction of, you know, replicating or inventing your own. So maybe tell us a bit about like how you turned airplane Noah's art into your art style.
Yeah, so I think starting with that, I mean, looking at, you know, I love doing a little bit of research on these things. I'm always trying to find some of the most hardcore kind of like jacket nose art pieces, and trying to trace back the history of, you know, maybe who produced that, who was the crew, who was the airman, whatever. I'm really fascinated by trying to take that back and find all the history on that. And then, you know, once I found an incredible image of a painted jacket, normally it's like a black and white image. Some of these, there's no real color references to a lot of these. So you're kind of taking something that was kind of produced by this M that maybe just had a little bit of artistic skill. But obviously the proportions are all off, but you kind of get the idea that actually he's replicated like an Alberto Vargas pinup, you know, who Alberto Vargas was a famous commercial artist in World War II. And then you can then trace that back to the source, which is obviously Alberto Vargas. And then you can have your own take on producing or replicating in some ways this artwork. But it's obviously your version. It is different. But I always kind of, I'm fascinated by taking something original and, yes, definitely making my own, but trying to make it a little bit more refined, I think, less primitive, I think is the kind of way I've been kind of looking at it. Yeah, I guess that's kind of it.
Very cool.
Sense. I've had two coffees, so I feel like I can see through time right now.
Don't go do any painting right now. You might get the jitters with the brush.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, your focus is primarily on either patches that would go onto bomber jackets or vintage jackets, or actually painting on the jackets themselves. Like a kind of a big portraiture on the back. What led you to work on garments in particular?
I think it's because it's kind of like what I was saying before. I think it's because, you know, I started work out doing portraiture, and I was a bit like, well, you know, what can I do? How can I, you know, incorporate this into something vintage? And that's when it kind of came hand in hand, and I was like, well, you know, I've got all these old leather jackets, and it would be quite interesting to see what would happen if I started painting on the back of them. And I think that for me, that was brilliant, because then it just meant that, you know, it was a great piece of self-development, because I was almost teaching myself how to paint again as well, you know, in another kind of different art form, essentially. But primarily, like you said, it's kind of like painting on jackets and the bomber patches. So the bomber patches, I mean, for me, you know, they're great to do. I don't mind doing them. Even though a lot of them are replicas and, you know, the commission really work I'll take on it. Maybe someone gets in touch and they're like, hey, can I just have, you know, the Memphis Belle on the back of an A2? And I'm like, well, that's great and all, but it doesn't excite me, because it's kind of like, I like the idea of, you know, adapting or, you know, kind of making it my own a little bit. And with the bomber patches, you know, I'm obviously happy to do them as well. I still get a buzz out of doing that, because then you're still doing the research and the history behind that all as well. I think that's, you know, it's important to kind of like retain that. But I get, you know, I love kind of bespoke commissions, and I've done a couple for Elia, and I've done a few for other people, and I love that, because it's kind of, you know, you're starting from, it's a conversation, isn't it? You're kind of like, you know, it's almost like a mood board. What do you want? It doesn't have to be military related at all. It could be very personal, but I really like that, because that's when it's really creative, because you're starting from, you know, conceptual sketches, and you're working up with, let's say, the client, and then you're refining this down to the artwork before you paint it. And it's just, I love that process. It's like, that's an exciting process, much more interesting than kind of like, you know, just painting replica of you know, a bomber patch or whatnot.
And on that end, go ahead, Ilya. Yeah.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask a question. Could you tell us a little bit about how the different formats of jackets, say, differ in your approach to producing them? So, like a jungle cloth versus leather jacket that you know that you've used.
Yeah, you mean like painting on?
Yeah.
So jungle cloth is actually a really interesting one. I think this is the great thing about like leathers and cottons, and you know, it's such a, like, it's an experiment. You know, I think that's the thing for me. I'm learning every time I paint on a new garment, whether it's like goat skin, horse hide. They all act differently when you paint on them. You know, they all react differently. But painting on like a deck jacket on that kind of jungle cloth is an interesting one. I'd say that. I mean, it can be very, very problematic. And I think the thing is with that, you know, it's a mark that's kind of indelibly made. You can't, once it's on, it's on. With leather, you can wipe it off, you know, if you want to, but you only get one shot with jungle cloth. I mean, you know, I did that piece, was it the USS Guardfish? It was almost like a watercolor, really, on the back of jungle cloth. And that was really interesting because I'd never used that before. And but what was interesting about it was like the textures from the jungle cloth and how it kind of resonated within these kind of like color washes. I wasn't really sure how it was going to turn out, but I was super happy with it. You know, it was, but that's another fun, like, example of like doing the research from an original jacket where, you know, you've got a really primitive artwork that's been painted on by the crewman. And then it's then having your take and then making it something else, but just taking inspiration from the original image. But yeah, to be honest, I love jungle cloth. I think it's great. Painting on it is great. Until you drop your brush on the jacket. And then you're in a whole world of hurt. So, yeah.
Thank you.
And one thing that that brings to mind is this notion of different mediums and kind of different ways of doing your artwork. I've seen kind of two very different ways of engaging with your art. So we did the art show, the gallery show you had off Brick Lane, and you know, you had a lot of your patches like in a glass case or like on an easel or sort of like displayed as pieces of artwork. But I remember there's also a chap who had previously commissioned you a patch that he was like wearing on his jacket and was using it kind of like just like a day-to-day garment, you know, kind of like living in it. How do you want people to engage with your artwork? Do you want them to like put on a jacket and beat it up? Do you want them to kind of put it on the wall? Like how would you want to have your art appreciated?
I think, you know, I'm more than happy for it, you know, to be worn. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about these things. And I think I go back to thinking about nose art again, and or just painting on jackets in general. It's kind of like, you know, seeing the wear. I'm kind of fascinated by that. How will it wear? So I think it's, when I do commissions, I'm more, you know, I think it's great, you know, stick it on a jacket. Maybe don't put it through the wash, and just, yes, just see how it wears down. I think I'm actually probably more fascinated by that than it probably, you know, being put in a mahogany case over the fireplace. Well, you know what I mean? It's like, I want to see the wear.
Very cool. And we've kind of talked a little bit about the idea of sort of nose art patches and, you know, kind of reproduction and custom. Maybe tell us about one instance where like you did like a repro that you really love, and maybe one instance where you had your own concept and that you really loved as well.
Okay. So repro wise, I was saying before, I'm always looking for like pieces that are really going to challenge me, that I know that will require a lot of research. And there was one piece that I did recently. And I mean, it took a lot of research, a lot of graphic artwork, digital graphic artwork in like in Photoshop to kind of recreate this thing. And it was definitely one of my favorites. It was actually in Men's File. There's a picture of her on the back. It's like Alberto Varga pinup on the back of like a 10-cent coin, whatever, with wings and everything. It's like nose art on steroids. Absolutely incredible. And within that, I put the original reference image as well, which is like the kind of crude, primitive version of that jacket. I would say that was one of my favorite pieces because it was painted on a vintage Willis & Geiger A2. They were contracted in World War II. to produce A2s as well, even though this was a later model. So I'd say that was one of my favorite pieces. In a way, you could say that was a replica, like a smart replica of that. And I think that, you know, on the other side of the coin, even though I'm using like a direct reference, I think that, you know, that USS Guardfish was a really fun one to do. And I quite like the idea of it's kind of a bit more freestyle, I think, in a way, you know, that I do enjoy that. I think it's a real mixed bag. You know, I think it really does depend. I really like doing the research and the development on new, fresh pieces and bespoke pieces. I couldn't actually give you one specific kind of like, oh, it's that piece. That's what I think sings for me, because it's just so varied, you know.
Very cool. And you kind of alluded to it just there, but maybe tell us a bit about the men's file cover. So for our listeners, if you are men's file readers, you'll probably have seen Ed on the cover of the most recent issue. So maybe tell us a bit about that experience.
So that was a pretty amazing experience, actually. So Nick got in touch from men's file at some point last year, and he just reached out and said, look, you know, I love what you're doing. It's great to see some, you know, some nose art and a traditional kind of approach to this. And, you know, can I shoot some of your jackets? And I was like, yeah, sure you can. So he came over, and it was, you know, I met him and he shot some of the jackets. And I think originally in his mind, it was like, well, you know, we'll put some little feature in men's file if you're up for it. I was like, yeah, like amazing. And then the more we talked, I think the more he was like, well, you know what, maybe we can make something more of this. Maybe it's an artist profile. Maybe, you know, there's more of a story behind this. And, you know, the talks that we had were kind of like, you know, it wasn't just about the painting. It was about the jacket restoration and conversion, because I'm really into that too. You know, that's like another part of it that I'm absolutely fascinated by. It's like the restoration of these vintage garments, trying to bring them back to life, or converting something that's inspired by an original World War II garment. So Nick saw all this stuff and he was like, right, you know what, let's do a shoot. So we did the shoot, shot loads of kit. I mean, I had three suitcases worth of stuff, and some of the kit is absolutely hilarious. I mean, it's like really full on hardcore kit. You know, I mean, Elia, you know, it's the US Army Air Force Arctic parka and matching pants and the boots and everything. I mean, you know, we did that for a shoot as well, Elia, didn't we? But
we did.
I've now got an original parka as well as a repro. But so anyway, we shot all this kit, and then I wasn't sure what was going to happen, really. Nick was like, well, look, you know, can you do a little write-up for us? And then he got back in touch a couple of weeks later. He went, I love Nick, he's great. He was like, hey, Ed, I just want to, how do you feel about, do you mind being on the cover of Men's File? And I was like, no, Nick, you're all right. And he was like, oh, well, okay. I was like, no, I'm joking. Like, yeah, that's great. Like, I'm up for it. Of course I'm up for it, you know. And I wasn't entirely sure what was going to go on the cover. And he actually sent it to me a couple of weeks before it kind of went out. And I was absolutely stoked. I mean, it's brilliant. It's a really cool shot. And very, very happy about that. And also a bit like, whoa, you know, this is serious.
But, it's the big leagues. Yeah,
pretty fantastic, actually.
It's famous now.
Yeah, I don't know about that. pretty blown away actually about that, and it is quite funny. There's definitely been a couple of times, which is, I think, you know, if you're in like the kind of Brick Lane area or like the vintage markets, now and again someone will just come up to you and go, I really like what you do, and they just kind of run off, and I'm like, all right, or like, are you Stanford? And I'm like, yeah, it's really weird. It doesn't happen often, by the way, just now and again. It's quite funny.
It's but yeah, good time. It's just me in disguise.
Yes,
it's you. Like, we do.
Yeah, hopefully it gets you some commissions.
Yeah, well, that's it, you know. So yeah, it's been great. I was very lucky to get that, and Nick's a great guy, and the shoot was amazing, and I feel very fortunate that it's a great community. Really is, definitely. That's another thing I've just to trail on and from that. I think that, you know, with you guys especially, and it's opened up a lot of doors, you know. It really has. It's a very supportive community, and I love it.
Yeah, speaking of community, we often see you're kicking it with Mr. Caborn. So what's it like collaborating with and hanging out with Nigel?
Good old Nige. It's great. Nigel's brilliant. He's got, as you guys know, his energy is just unmatched. You know, he's got such an infectious personality. He's very personable and he's so passionate about what he does. And I really admire that. I really do. I mean, I've known Nigel for about 6 years now. It actually kind of first started, the meetup's an interesting one because I was actually with my friend James down Brick Lane. We were in Leveson's vintage shop and Nigel was in there with Emily, his women's wear designer. And my mate James is a fashion photographer and he shot Nigel for Infantry magazine like years ago. So I was introduced to Nigel from James, from you know my friends, and then also Michael from Leveson's. And then from then onwards, I was like, well, look, you know, at that time I was still doing portraiture. I was still, you know, doing a lot of drawing and exhibitions and stuff. And so what I did was I said, look, can I do a portrait of you, like a portrait drawing? And he was like, oh, okay, fine. And Nigel's a funny one. He doesn't sit still for 2 minutes. Try and take a picture. He's just doing this. Like, just lay off the coffee, you know. And anyway, so I did a portrait drawing of him. And that's kind of what kickstarted our kind of friendship and in relationship in a sense. And then from then onwards, he was kind of like more invested in, he realized that I was really invested in vintage. He'd come to London on trips and say, hey, Ed, look, are you around? Do you want to go vintage shopping, do some research? I'd be like, yep, well up for it. And that's kind of how that relationship kind of kick-started. And I think the more that we've got to know each other, then that's when the collaborations have kind of like kicked off, which is amazing, you know. His studio is in Newcastle. It's absolutely incredible. Really is incredible. I mean, he's got like about 4,000 pieces of vintage up there. It's like, you know, kid in a candy shop, you know, it's unbelievable. And yeah, so it's been great. Worked on a couple of collaborations. One's going to be coming out in September, which was a collaboration with Umbro sports brand. So that'll be interesting to see kind of like how that comes out. Seeing a couple of prototypes, that looks good. Yeah, so all in all, I mean, it's great. We've got a good relationship. And I think what we do now is like, it's a lot of R&D. So we will go out and we'll just start searching garments for kind of, you know, future collections. And he's always happy to kind of get me involved within that. And I love that, you know, because that's right up my street. So he's a great person to work with. As I said, I really admire him. And he's 71 years old. I mean, and he looks about 50. I think he's pretty incredible. He also, what's interesting is he plays tennis 5 days a week and like boxes twice a week. I mean, he does more exercise than I do. Makes me feel tired.
Yeah, I've heard stories of him like pushing big giant tractor tires around when he's like traveling to work out.
Those things are heavy because when I go down to Newcastle, I've been a fair few times now. We'll always train together as well, which is really fun. Like those tires, they're beasts. You know, they are absolute beasts. But that's a big part of his life, and I think that's a good way to be. You know, it's a good role model in a way.
Awesome. And so you mentioned a bit about kind of projects coming forth with K-Born. What else is kind of in the future for you creatively?
I think creatively for me in the future, I've definitely got a few ideas, a few fingers and pies. I think that, you know, I'll continue to do the kind of nose art and that kind of work just because I think for me, on a personal note, I'm just fascinated by it. And it's, I think it's more for me than it is anything else, really. Do you know what I mean? But future-wise, I'm, you know, thinking about kind of brand development. You know, I've got, you know, my vintage archive is getting bigger and bigger. And I want to do something with it. And, you know, it's been like the last 4 years, that's been getting bigger and bigger. And it's continuing to grow. And, you know, I'm getting more and more rare pieces as the years go on now, as I'm selling older stuff. So I'm refining. And I want to do something with it. And, you know, I've got some ideas up my sleeve about some collections and going to be getting some friends involved with that at some point as well. Obviously, it's in its infancy at the moment. I'm not going to put too much pressure on it, but because I want to just kind of enjoy the processes to see what the potential could possibly be. Maybe it's prototyping or whatever, and maybe, well, let's just see, let's just say. But I think there's good stuff in the pipeline, definitely, that I feel really excited about, that I'm going to be investing a lot more time in. So, yeah, watch this space.
And without asking you...
Abstract answer, isn't it? So it's a really abstract answer. I didn't really give you a... It's like a politician.
No, so cool. I'm just taking it as you're going to create a museum full of cardboard boxes full of stuff in them, going full Rudy, Swiss jeans freak.
Yeah.
He's going for it, by the way, isn't it? He really is. Yeah, totally fair. To be honest, I mean, I've now got to think about a storage unit because it's, you know, flat as a spare room and it's full. It's almost like Narnia. It's like it's like the TARDIS. You open the door and you like just dive into this expanse. You know,
snorkel.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, to be honest, when I was getting ready for the shoot with Men's File, I got out about half of it and I was just kind of like, I could feel my pacemaker going up. I felt anxious. I was like, how have I got so much? I was like, this is like half of it. So I really got to start thinking about keeping it safe and stored properly because there's some seriously rare pieces. There really is. I'm just going to trail off on a story quickly, if that's okay.
By all means.
Found this incredible piece. I know some of you know this about this already. And I was where I live in Bow. I was on the number 8 bus, and I was on the top deck. And there's this kind of like, it's not really vintage, but it's like a bric-a-brac-y kind of like vintage kind of place. And they do like charity stuff there. And there was like, it was like light powder rain. And hanging outside was this bomber jacket. And I just had like a double take and I was like, ooh, that looks old. I was like, I'll go and have a look. And went and had a look and I just couldn't believe it. I was like, this is like a 1930s RAF Irving sheepskin. I was like, what is it doing hanging outside this shop? And it was absolutely unbelievable. And I got it for next to nothing. Absolutely next to nothing. And it's worth about 850 quid. So, I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, it's incredible condition. Those finds are just like, yeah, I love that. Thanks very much. Yeah, amazing.
A bit of an aside, and that's, you know, thinking about Rudy, which you just mentioned, and thinking about your collection or, you know, probably Nick or Nigel's collections. Interestingly, it seems like anyone who's into kind of vintage workwear and military always kind of has these great archives, but they're sort of at their own home, you know, kind of like for themselves. Why aren't we seeing more folks trying to like create little galleries or like little tiny, you know, museums that where you can kind of go and experience all these garments? Is there an obvious reason to that, or is it more just people haven't thought about trying to kind of make a thing out of it?
That's really interesting, actually. That's a really interesting thing. I think that I get the feeling that some collectors are a little bit, I don't want to say cagey is not the right word, but protective over what they have. And that I guess some collectors, I feel like on a personal level, that it's things they don't necessarily want to share, which is, you're right, it's a shame. It should be great to, you know, but I think also you've got to also remember that there's a lot of companies out there. There's a lot of kind of fashion brands that, it's, you know, they could just, I think there's a lot of people that are just quite cagey about ideas being taken and, you know what, and whatnot. So I think people are quite cagey about wanting to kind of put that out there to the net, if that makes sense in some ways. I think that's why, like, you know, there's vintage collectors that have showrooms that you pay to go to do the R&D work if you're looking to develop a brand or, which I do get that. I do get that in the sense of, you know, if you're a collector, you spend a lot of time and investment in this and, you know, it gives you the opportunity to then kind of like, you know, see these incredible garments. I think that kind of makes sense too. But I know what you're saying. I mean, to be honest, I'm not afraid to, like, you know, get my stuff and then put that out there. I pretty much do anyway, don't I?
There was a exhibition, I remember, is it last year or maybe 2 years ago, in a university in London where they had a lot of military garments mixed in with more modern style. And I can't remember, I've got a little booklet that came with it. It was just very close to Baker Street.
Yeah.
It was close to Baker Street. I don't know whether you went to that one, Ed. But it had a whole lineup of these items like in rows, so that was really fascinating to see how the military garments had inspired new designers like, you know, Alexander McQueen, G-Star, and, you know, so on. So it does happen, but it's just not as often, maybe.
Yeah, it is a shame. It is a shame, definitely. It would be nice to see more of it, or kind of like more exhibited, definitely. That would be quite cool, you know. Yeah, who knows what the future holds with that, definitely. But it would be nice to see more of it out there, definitely.
Kind of a related one. So obviously, if you live in the UK, the Imperial War Museums are a great place for someone to go and learn about World War II and sort of a lot of the history there. And, you know, like in the States, for example, New Orleans has an amazing World War II museum. But if folks wanted to learn more about, let's say, the artwork of World War II, you know, the nose art, the jackets, where might you recommend they go to kind of start learning more about this part of history?
I'd say go to Duxford, because there's some incredible stuff at Duxford, not just the aircraft, but, you know, there's a gallery of these jackets there too. You know, there's some incredible nose art on original A2s there. And I think that there's a fair amount of history around that, and it's just an incredible place to visit. I think the Imperial War Museum is great. You know, I absolutely love it. But I think that when it comes to kind of like World War II gallery and you know, the visuals on these kind of jackets, there really isn't much there. You know, it's more focused on the kind of World War I and aircraft than it is around the kind of like World War II kind of that kind of nose art. But I think Duxford is a really good shout, definitely, to go and check that out.
If anyone does go to Duxford, hit me up. I now live about a 10-minute cycle from there, so
I can that over. Sounds good. That I wouldn't mind maybe necessarily taking my bike up there, my motorbike.
Yeah,
up there.
That'd be cool.
So I can side by side with you on your all black or neon bike.
Push bike.
I'll follow you in my bright white Nissan Juke.
Lads, I'll be in the Spitfire.
Oh. Yeah. Just yesterday, we saw one flying over while my girlfriend and I were going for a walk, and you can like pay a couple thousand pounds, which is a lot of money, fair enough, but to actually go up in a Spitfire. And apparently they've got a volunteer group, which I don't know if you've ever reached out to them or not, Ed, but there's a volunteer group that maintains a B-17 bomber. Mm. And it's like all volunteers. So it's not actually owned by IWF, but they let the bomber stay there, and it's all like local volunteers who maintain it. So who knows, maybe you're getting involved and helping with some of the like paint maintenance or something.
Well, that thing's incredible. It's called the Sally B, but it's if my memory stands correct. But they also used that in the shooting of the Memphis Belle film in the 90s. So on one side, you got the Sally B artwork. On the other side, you got the Memphis Belle, which is an interesting one. But that's beautiful. That's from the Heritage Hangar, isn't it? And I actually remember going there when they had the engines off, and I got up close and personal to it. Absolutely incredible, that thing. Yeah, it's an amazing piece of kit. But you're right. There could be an opportunity there as well. Be great. Imagine that. Imagine actually doing some nose art on an aircraft. That would be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. But I'd be well up for it.
Have you done any vehicles or anything like that?
Haven't done any vehicles, and that's yet to come. I did entertain it at one point with a P-51 Mustang, actually, World War II fighter, and but that kind of just went a bit quiet, because I think it was more just kind of like thrashing around ideas, but that would have been pretty special. That really would have been, yeah, but who knows? Who knows?
Well, do you want to do my Peugeot 207?
Yeah, sure. And a couple of Go Faster stripes and flames. Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Tom, I'm your man.
I guess on that note, let's say someone does listen to this podcast and want to commission you for something, either, you know, a piece for a jacket, a patch, or even something bigger. What's the best way to get in touch and to sort of to kick off a conversation with you?
I think the best way is just what's that, Tom?
OnlyFans.
I think the best way just to contact me, just message me through Instagram, through Stanford Vintage, and I will pick up the messages, and then, you know, open the conversation. That's the easiest way to do it, because, you know, I'm pretty much always on that. So
that's Stanford, Stanford _ Vintage, right?
Yep, that's the one. That's the one.
Awesome.
They can find me there.
Very cool. Well, it's been awesome having you on the show, Ed. You know, we love hanging out with you in our meetups in London. It's always great to see you as part of the community.
Yeah, you too.
Any last bits you want to chat about before we wrap up the conversation?
I think that's, you know, most things covered, really, to be fair. I think all I want to say, really, is just thank you to the support from the community. because it has been amazing, actually. A lot of people have reached out and been really supportive and vice versa. So that's gone a long way for me, definitely. And that continues to grow. So kind of a big thank you to everyone, really, I'd say. And yeah, that's kind of it.
Awesome. Well, I might suggest it's a good point for us to wrap up for today. We're at roughly the 2-hour mark. So obviously, Ed, thanks for being our discussion topic guest today and for hanging out and kicking it with us. It was good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
And for listeners, you know, please check out Ed's work at Stanford _ Vintage, STANFORD. Obviously, please rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at Sons of Selvage Podcast. Shoot us a message on Instagram if you have any questions. And obviously, give us a shout if you want to jump onto our Discord. It's open to everybody that wants to hang out. And yeah, thanks, everybody. Hope to see you again next episode.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks again, Ed. Awesome. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Cheers, thank you.
Bye.
See ya.